Welcome to the Adventure Audio Podcast. In this episode, Laval and I have the pleasure of interviewing Helen Dainty. She goes by Hells on Wheels. That's HELS.on.wheels on Instagram, which is an awesome, awesome Instagram page to follow. She has been traveling the world by bicycle since 2017. I'll just let that sink in a little bit. And I will let the episode talk for itself. Helen is an absolutely incredible and inspiring person, and her natural curiosity for the world around her is really, really cool to see. So what a pleasure to chat with her. We will absolutely be having her back on because she's traveling around to different parts of the world. So we'll have nothing but more questions for her. Helen, thank you so much for making the time. We really appreciate it. We hope you enjoy this episode of the podcast. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the State Bicycle Company, who you can visit at statebicycle.com. And they are bringing an exclusive deal to Adventure Audio listeners right now. If you use code AUDIO23, so AUDIO23, you will get 23% off your order right now from State Bicycle Company. So State already represents unbelievable value for both bicycles, parts, and apparel. Really anything that you see on that website is incredibly well priced. So to get an additional 23% off is a fantastic deal. So please visit them at statebicycle.com and use code AUDIO23. The podcast is also brought to you by Rewire Fitness. It's a mental fitness platform that helps athletes reach their full potential and avoid burnout by providing integrated tools that improve readiness, recovery, and resilience. We all know that mental toughness contributes to at least 50% of our athletic performance, yet how much time do we actually spend training our minds? So that's where Rewire comes in. The neuro buttons from Rewire are ideal for indoor cycling practices. With brain training layered into your workouts, you can improve your ability to cope with mental demands and build mental fitness. To learn more, visit rewirefitness.app for 45% off today. 45%. Visit rewirefitness.app. So thank you to State and to Rewire. On to this episode of the podcast.
Well, I'm pretty excited to have Hells on Wheels, Helen Dainty, on the podcast. We first met, well, we've only met once, and we were in the Al Hajar Mountains of Oman. I had walked out of a supermarket buying food for my bike packing trip, and I saw this Western cyclist across the street, and she was at this pretty dodgy bike shop. And I walked over there and I said, "Hi, what are you doing?" And she said, "Oh, my headset's loose." And so myself, her, and the bike shop guy tightened her headset. And
mostly you, I think.
Yeah. And then next thing you know, I'm like, "What are you doing?" And she basically just sort of said, "Oh, I'm just, I don't know, riding around for the past several years, riding around the world." And I went, "What?" So I found her on Instagram. And I've been following you ever since, and it's fantastic. So, Helen Dainty, welcome to the Adventure Audio Podcast.
Thanks, heaps.
Thanks for making the time to do this. Very cool to have you. As soon as Laval told me about what you've been doing for a long time, I mean, it's not even, we can't even really call it a trip anymore, really, right? Like, this is now your lifestyle. At what point did that sort of change?
When did it change? Was in Australia, and that was supposed to be for about a year, and something happened during that that trip where I guess some kind of switch flicked, and I realized, no, this is what I'm gonna do from now on. And then it was just a case of trying to find a way to make it financially viable, because prior to that I would work for a couple of years, go on, you know, some adventure for a year, work for a couple of years again. But yeah, since 5 years ago now, I've been able to sort of sustain traveling basically full-time now.
And what's interesting about it is I've been doing lots of research on you, Helen, now because of the fact that you've agreed to be on our podcast. But your bikepacking life started with a nine-month trip through Australia. You're obviously a Brit, yes, judging by your accent, but had gone to Australia not because you're on a prison ship, but because you wanted to live there. And then you decided to go on a nine-month walkabout, rideabout, through Australia, and you were not a bike packer before that.
No, I think I've counted. I've only owned like about four bicycles in my life, including childhood bikes. I'm not a cyclist, or I wasn't a cyclist at all. It's a little bit involved, but basically I was applying for my Australian citizenship and I'd already used up my quota of time that you're allowed to be overseas without jeopardizing your application. And I'd done my, you know, work for a couple of years and I was ready to go on another trip for a year, but I was sort of stuck in Australia. And I'd already driven around in a camper van and I'd already sort of taken the bus around. So I had been wondering, when I'd driven around in a very old Toyota Tarago, it wouldn't go down a lot of the dirt roads. And I began to wonder if you could ride a bicycle down dirt roads. I was so ignorant. I didn't even know that that was possible. And yeah, it turns out there's some magnificent four-wheel drive tracks and off-road, like epic two-week trips you can take from town to town in Australia. So with a little bit of research, and it's, you know, it's not necessarily the best way to start your bike touring life, is with, you know, something as gargantuan as Australia. Much better to start with like a Eurovelo route maybe. But yeah, very quickly I realized that that was the thing for me. And fortunately, having bought a very expensive bike and a very expensive tent, I took to it, thank goodness. And yeah, so that's become full time now since that one big Australia trip.
And if I recall that Australia trip, you were with a bloke and he jammed out and had to hitchhike out because yeah, he couldn't make it down these dirt roads.
There was two. There was my my boyfriend at the time. We set off together, and by the time we got from Brisbane to Darwin, he'd made the very correct decision for him to bail, that it wasn't his thing at all. He was, you know, super supportive. He wanted to, you know, do the thing that made me happy, but it wasn't his thing at all. So he bailed in Darwin. And then I was left with heading down what's called the Gibb River Road, very famous Australian dirt track, basically between Darwin and Broome, effectively. And I'd never ridden a dirt road in my life. I didn't know if I was capable or if the bike was up to the job. But yeah, I found a guy on like a Facebook forum. He was heading the same way. Or rather, he was going to take the dirt roads, but he said, oh, okay, if you're going to take the off-road, then I'll come with you. And yeah, he made it two or three days in and bailed. He hitchhiked out because, yeah, it was tough going. But I did know, like, I'm incredibly indebted to him, because having him next to me, you know, an experienced bike tourer, just gave me the courage to set out those first few kilometers, just, you know, with somebody as moral support. And famously, it is like the eastern end of the road is the harder part. So, you know, I knew that if I could just cover those first two or three days, get through the crocodile infested rivers and all of that stuff. If I could get through those first few days, then, you know, you could either turn back and go back through the same terrain, or you could carry on west where it would get easier. So by the time I decided that it wasn't for him at that point, I was already invested enough and brave enough at that point to continue.
There's something poetic about the fact that natural selection kicked in Darwin and the survival of the fittest kicked in and you were the fittest. There's something about beautiful that there. So when you do write your book, that has to be the opening chapter.
Oh, Darwin. I'm definitely plagiarizing that. Thank you. Yeah.
So you spent 9 months touring all over Australia. And then as that started to conclude, you were like, I'm not ready to stop living like this. So I'm just going to keep riding my bike.
Yeah, I was enticed back to work for a year. But yeah, it was a package I couldn't refuse for 1 year. But then after that, I found a way to switch to like full time bicycle touring. I flew over from Australia to the UK. I had a wedding to attend in Italy. So I rode around the coast of the British Isles and then cycled to the wedding. And then basically from that point, in 2018, I was trying to cycle to Istanbul for three straight years. In 2018, I had to turn back in Italy and go back to the UK to have some dental work done. In 2019, I set off again from London at the start of the year, but I had another wedding to attend. So that time I did, rather than get to Istanbul that year, I did a circular route up the Atlantic coast to the North Cape. I was there for the tail end of summer. So I had like 24 hours daylight, which was amazing. I got stuck in a storm at the North Cape, but when the storm died down at 2 o'clock in the morning, I could set off in broad daylight.
With your sunnies south. On?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was 2019. And then 2020 was the third year in a row that I said, right, this time I'm definitely cycling to Istanbul. And obviously we all know what happened in 2020.
Where were you stuck? Where did you get stuck in 2020? Where were you?
I got as far locked as down? Munich. I set off in the start of March 2020.
Ooh, good timing.
Oh my God. At the time it was an epidemic. And at the time I literally said to myself, oh, okay, I guess I can't go to Italy this year. Like that was the situation. And then as I rode along, as I crossed, you know, borders from like England to France, to Belgium, to Germany, I remember like there's video footage of me like earnestly saying to myself in the camera, they can't close the European borders. How would that even work?
I know. Early days in the pandemic, if I had to listen to quotes that I said of how I thought it was going to go, I mean, I would be so far off base. So many of us thought, I thought we were all going to be home for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I was in Somalia when it hit. I was bikepacking and adventuring in Somalia, and it was March 6th. I remember contacting my wife saying, something's going on. I think they're going to lock everything down. I got to get out of here. So I left about a week early. March 11th, the world shut down. Or I'd still be in Somalia.
Yeah. No, I counted myself lucky to be in Germany, actually. It was, I actually, in the course of the whole, you know, 2 years or whatever we're calling the pandemic, I only was in one lockdown, and that was in Munich. That was for 7 weeks. And then from that point on, I changed my route according to where the borders opened. I did like big loops of countries, like waiting, like Greece famously didn't open for ages.
You just held in Macedonia, if I remember it. You're just sort of in a holding pattern riding around Macedonia.
Yeah, Macedonia. Well, I got COVID in Macedonia. That was a surprise because I took the test to cross the border. Macedonia celebrate Christmas in January, and I wanted to cross to Bulgaria to celebrate Christmas in December. So I just rocked up, took the test, ready to cross the border, and they said, no negative test for you. So I got stuck in Macedonia, obviously in quarantine, in isolation for Christmas, and then. Travel, the snow had descended on the mountains. It would have been a miserable time to cross. I think I also was waiting on an ATM card. Or so. Anyway, I ended up stuck for the winter in Macedonia.
So where do we find you now? I mean, I know where you are, but our listeners don't. So where do we find you now? Because we met each other in Oman, and you're continuing on, eventually heading into Saudi. So where are you right now?
I'm in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, in Jeddah specifically.
And what an unusual trip.
Yeah, it's not boring.
And you still have your police escort? Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, let's talk about that. It's all still really, really fresh. And I've had various traffic police escorts, which initially I kind of resented because, you know, we solo travelers are independent by nature and we don't always appreciate somebody sort of like chivying you along and like looking at their watch every time you want to. They don't, bless them, you know, in their car, they don't understand that sometimes you just need to get off the bike and stand and have a snack and something. And you know, when you've got somebody waiting for you, you do feel a sort of time pressure to not keep them waiting. So initially I quite resented the traffic cops, but then I started being followed by these unmarked cars, which all signs point to it being something to do with the Ministry of the Interior, who I believe just have my best interests at heart. But the way they went about following me without any sort of notification or consent on my part was deeply terrifying. But over the last kind of couple of weeks, it's sort of because the people that I meet in these cars, they're not willing to speak to me always. And if they do, they don't have a lot of English. So I just had no idea what was going on. But piecing things together, it seems to be that the Ministry of Interior are just really, really, really being careful about my safety, which ironically had the effect of deeply afraid because I was being followed by strange men in cars for a number of days. So yeah, that's where I'm at in Saudi right now.
No good deed goes unpunished, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly.
How interesting. I mean, one thing I noticed about my riding in the Middle East, and I'm sure you can attest to this, is the absolute ridiculous hospitality of the locals. The way they will basically lock up their brakes in a lorry to try and give you a frozen fish or dates or water. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's incredible. You have to turn kilos of dates down. Like before I got wise to it, if somebody offered me some dates, I would say, okay, sure, that'd be lovely. And
Yeah.
then you get to a point where you have like multiple kilos, because they come in packs of a kilo, right? You have kilos,
I had a lot of
multiple
dates.
kilos of dates. Yeah. So and I came on an unfinished road between the part of Saudi between Qatar and Bahrain. There's a road that's like 95% finished, but it was a bit of a shortcut. So I took that, and it was a kind of a last minute decision. And I sort of thought, oh, I haven't really got enough food with me, or I've got like one day of food, but I was looking at 3 days riding. I've got some water, but I could see that there were a few cars on this road, even though it wasn't complete. But I had enough experience in Saudi Arabia by this stage already to know that if there were people on the road, then I absolutely wasn't going to go hungry. And in actual fact, each night I finished the day with more water than I'd begun the day with. Like I was
Isn't that the
accumulating,
truth?
I was accumulating food stocks as I went. Just everyone just wants to
Yeah.
Do a Snapchat with you, take photos, give you food, water, invite you to their home. Saudi and Iran are the two most welcoming countries in that respect, hands down.
Yeah. And I've ski
Wow.
mountaineered in Iran, and that's when I noticed shepherds in the middle of nowhere in the mountains of Iran would basically drag you into their yurt to feed you tea. And if you can get around
Yeah.
their ferocious dogs that protect their flocks from the wolves, then you're okay. But yeah, fantastic. So speaking of water and food, and then Pete's gonna get in here, but I find this so fascinating. The most water I've had to carry on a bike is about 13 liters. And that was on an Arctic bike ride here in northern Canada, where there was a stretch where there was just no water, which sounds unusual in the Arctic. But you've biked in obviously in the deserts of the Middle East. You've biked in obviously Australia, which is dry. What's the most weight you've had to carry on this beast of a bike of yours?
27 kilos of water.
27 kilos of water.
Which is
Yeah, there was this.
65 pounds. About that.
Yeah, I don't know. 27
It's tw
liters. I
it's
don't know
twenty
in Imperial.
it's 27 liters, 27 kilos. Yeah. So for
That was
Americans
in.
watching, wow.
Yeah, I don't know the Imperial. It's enough. It's more than enough. This was in Australia again on one of these dirt tracks. It's called the Tanami. It goes from if Australia was like a clock, it goes from Broome in like sort of 10 o'clock down to Alice Springs in the centre. It's 1,300 kilometres, but there is a stretch where you have to do. It's 238 kilometres between water sources, and it's a dirt road. So for me, I do about 80 kilometres a day on, sand corrugations. And they reckon 9 litres a day in Australia at that time of year. So 3 days, 9 litres, 27 litres. And I checked in advance. Obviously, you have to. Some of these water holes are dry. You have to, do your due diligence and make sure that there's going to be water when you get there. But still, I was down to my last litre, I think, by the time I got to this sort of big, water tank. And you sort of peek over the top, and like the elation when you find that there is indeed
Oh,
water in it. And
so amazing how critical water is when you're in these places.
oh, so much. Yeah. It's a great relief at that moment to see water in there for sure.
So, can we go back just a little bit as you embarked on this lifestyle? I'm really
Too much
curious to
stuff to
know
talk about.
how you, yeah, so much stuff. Oh my God, I hope you have 3 hours. How did you build your setup? And did you have like a home in the UK that you completely deconstructed? And did you like get rid of possessions and stuff? Or did you store some things and think I'll get back to that one day? And then your bike setup and your equipment that you take with you, is that constantly evolving? Or have you kind of narrowed it down to what you need and it's good for all climates and all countries and situations?
So I've been traveling one way or another for approaching 20 years now. So each time I go away, I sort my things into piles of like put store that, chuck that, take that. So each time I've gone away, this collection of things has got smaller and smaller. Excuse me. So I've whittled it down to the point that now all of my possessions are either with me on a bicycle, or I have one backpack of lifetime souvenirs, which sits in my parents' house. So that's everything that I have. My job in Australia was in travel, so I never had a full-time base, which is also how I was able to sort of save the money to start living full-time on the bicycle. Because I flew in, flew out, the job came with accommodation, so I was, you know, free of any of those type of bills. And it also meant that I didn't have a house to pack away when it came time to leave. I'm naturally always in a sort of state of packed, if you like. So that was quite simple. And then in terms of my kit, still the same bike, still the same tent, just about. Been through a couple of air mattresses, but otherwise, the clothes obviously depend on the climate. Right now I'm having to carry a surprising amount, because you have to, you know, Islamic clothing is, there's quite a lot of it, even though it's, you know, quite nice weather. I don't have a raincoat, but you have to have a lot of clothing to cover your body, both on and off the bicycle. But otherwise it's evolved down, I suppose, in a small way. In Australia, I had to carry like often a whole big pannier of food. Whereas here in the Middle East, even, you know, crossing the desert, there's like a service station every 70 or 80 kilometers. I haven't needed to carry more than like a day's worth of food. So it's not exactly nearly as remote as some of the places in Australia. So yeah, it's.
No, Helen, you're on you're still on Gibbo, that still have the same Viventi Gibbs. Is that what where you're still riding?
Yeah.
So,
exactly right,
so for people who are not familiar with this bike, it's an Aussie brand, and it would be like almost like a Dutch utility bike. So it's a heavy duty bike, mountain bike, like a flat bar setup with panniers on it. And you have gone to carbon belt drive and roll off hub, right? And you've got some unbelievable mileage off of this thing.
I've always had the roll off. Yeah, I better touch some wood. 71,000 kilometers.
Wow.
So, yeah, I don't know how long a roll-off hub is supposed to last. Like, roll-off will tell you that they don't know the expectation of it, because they haven't had one fail yet.
You're their best chance to find out, probably.
Holy cow.
I hope not. So, but they're really good, actually. I did have a warm showers host that assured me he knew what he was doing. He was going to change the cog for me, and he accidentally broke it a little bit. But I took it into Roloff in Kassel in Germany, and they completely repaired it. They did the parts and the labor and everything for free, and gave me a t-shirt as well. So even though it was like user error,
This is a Roloff advertisement right now.
Yeah, well, they did well to service it for free, because I'll tell everybody that'll listen like how awesome they are. So yeah, it's the same hub from the start, but my frame did break in Macedonia just as I was crossing the border into Albania. Montenegro into Albania. And so Vivente couriered me one from Tasmania to Albania. And,
wow.
I've got like lots of good things to say about Vivente as well, for sure. That was no fuss, sent me a frame straight away. And it happened to be a carbon belt compatible one. So I also at the time was encouraged to open a Patreon account, and I was gifted the cost of converting the bike from chain to belt drive, and that was back in Greece 2 years ago. So I guess I've done about 20,000 kilometers on the carbon belt now, I think.
On the same belt.
Yeah. I should probably start looking at how long. Yeah, I think a belt's supposed to last 20 or 30,000. I have a list somewhere of how old all the bike parts are.
What about your saddle? I heard last time I heard your saddle had 50,000 K on it. So what's it at now?
No, it's the same saddle. It's 71,000, and
shit!
It is a point of people have offered me a new saddle. People have said I'll pay for it, but actually, it looks really worn, and I think it's been clawed at by a dog or a crow or something.
It's a patina. It looks perfect now. It's got a real life to it now.
I'm quite attached to it, figuratively. So I'm just very afraid. I think I'm afraid, you know, of change now.
Don't jinx it. Leave it on.
Yeah.
Ride it till it falls off or it grows into your butt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What was the frame that broke? Is it a steel bike?
Steel? Yes.
It is. Yeah.
So I guess that, yeah, it must have been steel, right? Yeah, I took it to a car repair place. They for me. And then while I was waiting for it to arrive, it only took like about a week or something from Tassie, but I did like a little trip around North Albania. I can't remember the name of the route, but there's this mad climb up and down, like this just horrendously steep dirt road that even as I was doing this loop and even as I was descending this dirt road, I was saying to myself, oh, thank goodness I don't have to come back over this way. But I got to the bottom and they said, no, that's the only way in and out of town. You're going back the same way. Oh. yeah, miserable. But yeah, I came in and out on this sort of on the weld job. They did a really good job welding. And then by the time I got back to Shkodra, I think it is, in North Albania, the new frame was waiting for me there. And in Tirana, the bike shop in Tirana fixed it up for me. And then I rode from Albania to Greece, I guess for about 6 or 9 months or whatever that was with the chain. And then I got it converted to belt in Athens.
Amazing. What a bike. Like, this thing's a tank, Pete. You got to see it. Like, when I saw her, she was going, I was leaving the next day to cycle up the highest mountain in Oman, and she was headed up there too. And I remember looking at her bike thinking, pardon me, there's no way you could ride this bike up that, because that's a steep climb, as you know. And you said you're going to hitchhike. Yeah. And you actually got up there because I saw your photos of you camped up there.
I changed my mind. I had this. Yeah, it was exactly when I spoke to you, like hours before the event, it was my intention to hitchhike. And then that morning I woke up and I looked at the gradient and stuff on Komoot. And I don't know if I misread it or I was just feeling very optimistic, but I said, nah, I'll give it a red hot go. And yeah, cycled up it. And it was, I mean, I say cycle, there was a bit of pushing, but yeah, I got there.
That gravel bit is pretty brutal around that last gravel bit before you get back to the pavement.
miserable. Absolutely.
Good for
miserable.
You. I can't Thanks. Believe this. Like, I think I'd rather pedal a Land Cruiser up there than pedal that bike up there. That's how heavy that bike was. You had that thing loaded.
Yeah. I mean, because I wasn't sure about shops either. So I did have quite a bit of food and, again, water. I mean, as you know, there was like a couple of mosques on the way up to with water, but I didn't really know that for sure. So I carried more than I needed that day as well.
One thing I want to touch on is that you were obviously raised by some pretty incredible parents. And I've heard in one interview you said that your dad gave you and your brothers roots and wings. Now, it sounds to me like you're fully winged out, but where are your roots? Are they in, are you from Yorkshire? Where are you from in the UK exactly?
I was born in the Lake District, but and I used to answer the question, where are you from, with that. But then when I did the loop around the British Isles and I revisited where I spent the first 6 years of my life, I realized that I just felt really fraudulent saying that I'm from the Lake District, because I have no recollection of the place at all. And yeah, I lived in Yorkshire very briefly, but I had my teenage years in the West Midlands, which is where my parents still live. So that is probably the closest thing to answering where I am from. That's where my accent is. That's where my parents still have a house. That's where my bag of possessions is. So that is.
So those, that's where your root, that's where your roots are.
Currently, yes.
Interesting. And then you bounce all over the world on you've got an Oz passport and a British passport.
Yeah.
Now, does it matter which one you travel with, or are they both equal for getting you in and out of countries?
No, you cannot get into Iran on a British passport. So, and Turkey, it's free. Australians have to pay quite a big visa fee. So I did leave London most recently on my British passport so that I arrived in Turkey cheaply. And then I had to switch between Turkey and Iran. In between Georgia and Armenia, I had to switch between passports, which I've never done before, and is actually harder than I realized, because I didn't want to be, you know, fussing around with a British passport at the Iranian border, because that was just gonna cause problems. So yeah, currently in Saudi Arabia on my Australian passport. So the authorities here understand me to be Australian, and I can hear them chatting amongst themselves. And, you know, I can hear that people know who I am. Like, obviously word has got around, and I can hear people chatting about the Australian in Arabic around me. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of Australian, Pete, I think you read this as well, that Helen is originally was doing this on 100 Aussie dollars a week. That was your goal.
Still, yeah.
Still doing that?
Yeah, yep.
400 Australian dollars per month.
I don't know what that is in US dollars, but
we're Canadian. We're Canadian, so it's 400 Canadian dollars, the same as Aussie, basically.
It's almost exactly the same. So you're living for $5,000 a year.
Well, so I have 5,000, yeah, so 100 weeks a week, and then I have like 1,800 or 2,000 if you want to. If I have to, you know, get the bike serviced or buy a plane ticket. So, you know, if there's like a big expense, but yeah, week to week, it's $100 a week. And then there's like 2,000 for like bigger expenses. So 7,000 a year. And I, you know, I keep very careful track of it all. And I've been living on that since the Australian trip. So 2016, whatever that was.
Do you frequently now get, because you blog about, right? Mm-hmm. Do you frequently now get people reaching out saying like, what is the roadmap for me to live like this?
Some people, I get a few people asking for like quite specific people want to know what tent I have, or like not so much tell me how to be a bicycle tourer.
They want to know some specifics about like actually work, right? Because like your tent, for example, is extremely important. It's something you can take lightly if you're going away for a night or two, but you know, you had to carefully consider every piece of gear that you take with you. So much more than typical bike packers.
Yeah.
Plus you're traveling as a female too, in some pretty dodgy parts of the world. And I've heard interviews with you about that. And you've made a couple of mistakes, you said, where you've gotten a little bit, too relaxed about where you're camping or what time you set up camp, and you've been robbed.
Yeah, I did get robbed sleeping on a beach in Greece. I checked into a hostel. The plan was to check into a hostel the next day. So I slept on the beach to save $20 and got robbed. And because I'd just come off a ferry, like ordinary, I have two passports, two wallets. They live in separate parts of the bicycle. But because everything was together from being on the ferry, I lost everything. Could have been worse. They didn't take my bike. So, and actually it was incredibly fortunate because there was a British consulate on the island of Crete where I was. So I had an emergency travel document within 48 hours off the Brits. And again, by chance, I had a family member flying in for a visit anyway, who happened to be bringing with me a couple of ATM cards that had expired anyway. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was the luckiest time for a robbery.
That's a mixture of luck and misfortune you had there, Helen. But in 71,000 kilometers, how many crashes? What's the most serious injury you've had?
Oh no, I've touched some more wood. I've taken a few tumbles, obviously. Although, no, I have a friend who says that you don't say that. You say you stepped off. So I've stepped off a couple of times. Collision I've ever had is in the UK. It was like really strong headwind and rain. So I had my head down, you know, to just keep the rain out of my eyes. Head down. I was like pushing slowly on. And I just rode into the back of a stationary vehicle. That's the absolute worst that it's been for me.
In 71,000 K, that's it?
So far.
Well, let's hope that I don't jinx you now, but that's amazing. Good for you. And what about illness? You've obviously had some dodgy water and some gastrointestinal issues, I'd imagine, with all this traveling.
Yeah, not as much as you might think. I think because I have been traveling for so long, and I've just grown accustomed to drinking tap water all over the world. So I do have a pretty strong constitution, I think, for the most part.
What about overuse injuries? Like, are you actively doing anything to prevent that, or do you have some sort of like cross training routine, or you just ride all the time?
Yeah, just that. I mean, in the winter time, generally I've not this winter because I'm in the Middle East and winter is a nice time to ride here, but when I've been in Europe, I've taken the winters off and then I return to running, and I get immediately injured when I'm a runner, when I'm running. I love it, but
it's such a classic cyclist move too, though, right? Because you've got a big engine and you think, and you can cardiovascularly run for a really long time, yeah, but every time at least use injuries.
Yeah.
If you go from 0 to 100 with running. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, but with cycling, sometimes my knees get a bit sore and I just take that as a sign that I need to raise the saddle a little bit. No overuse injuries as yet.
When I was in Oman, I got a message on Instagram from a Canadian cyclist, a female, and she said, "It looks incredible, but too bad me as a female, I would not be able to ride there." And I said, "Well, I think as long as you cover up your legs," I hadn't seen any female cyclists. And the next day, I saw you in Al Hajar in Oman. And then I sent a message back saying, "I just saw a Western girl wearing biking shorts, short sleeve jersey, full Lycra, like you'd see here in outside of Calgary or anywhere in the UK riding your bike. And no issue whatsoever." Now, obviously, Saudi's stricter, and I'm sure in Iran too you had to cover up, but I think that people build, in my travels especially in the Islamic world, people build these narratives that it's such a dangerous place, such an unfriendly place to women travelers. So what can you say about that?
Well, in regards to Oman in particular, I think Oman is the safest place that I've possibly ever been. Like, I stopped even really thinking too hard about where I even put my tent. I just, you know, it came time to camp, I just dropped my tent anywhere, like in broad, you know, in full view of anybody and everyone. On one occasion, I had the light on inside the tent and somebody came to have a look, and he drove up in his car, headlights on, and I poked my head out of the tent, and this poor man was so embarrassed to have approached a woman in a tent. He couldn't get away. He couldn't back away fast enough. He was so apologetic. It's just the absolute safest, best place to wild camp in Oman. And I feel completely safe amongst Arab men across Oman, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates. I'm sure I had the same preconceptions as many people did, but I've been in the Arab part of the Middle East since last year, 6 months, let's say. And yeah, I really enjoy it. Different from Iran, where you know, the mullahs maybe don't even want to look at me, you know, because it's haram to even look at me. But here, Arab men will have a conversation with me. They'll look me in the eye, but they also pathologically will not come within. If you're in a supermarket and there's a tight space, nobody's going to do that thing of like, "Oh, sorry, squeeze back." No, absolutely not. So people treat you with dignity. They talk to you, but they also
respect
your personal space as well.
It's so good. It's so important that cyclists know this, female cyclists that are being held back. You know, they could completely strike off parts of the map because they think that they're going to be unable to ride there. And I think it's amazing to watch you do this. And you're just, I mean, you're cycling through Saudi Arabia, I find so fascinating. And the fact that they've treated you with so much respect and given you a personal protective, I don't know, cover. It's just amazing.
They're killing me with kindness, basically. Like, they want to be so hospitable, and there is a culture clash between my desire for liberty to travel freely within the country and their enormous desire, responsibility even, to keep me safe. There's a bit of a clash between those two things, which doesn't sit very comfortably at the moment.
Well, my next question is, so like, we're recording this in early February, so what is the plan for the rest of your 2023? Are you following good weather? Are you going to cycle the entire year? Are you going to have a rest period built into this year?
Yeah, I have missed having the winter off. This is the first time I've cycled straight through, so this is already my longest tour without, you know, stopping for any sort of significant break, which my body has sort of noticed, let's say, I just sort of missed that break. So I probably do need to sort of factor something like that in. But right now I'm heading towards Jordan. I should be in Jordan in March, in Palestine and Israel around Easter time. And then I'll be getting to Egypt for May. Wow. Yeah, it would be nice to be in Ethiopia by the summer, just to be in the cooler mountains. But I think that's going to be too much of a rush. So yeah, because I haven't had the winter off, that's when I normally do like a lot of very diligent planning work. And so I just haven't had that opportunity yet. So yeah, I'm zooming towards a year cycling down the eastern side of Africa without really actually having planned it very much yet.
Cairo to Cape Town.
That's it.
So I know what I love about bikepacking. I love the simplicity of riding to the end of the day, setting up your camp, brewing up dinner, and you have really no possessions other than your tent and your sleeping bag and your stove. Mm-hmm. And then packing up the next day, and it's just such a simple goal to just ride your bike to the end of the day and set up camp again. And it's so fantastic on the route. So for you as a world bike tourer now, and it sounds to me like this is what you're going to be doing for forever. What is it about bike touring? What is it about bike touring? Tell our listeners what it is that makes you want to ride your bike for between 60 and 100K a day, every day.
I mean, when you put it like that, I don't know if that's what I actually want to always do. But it's a way for me to experience the world and people and landscapes and food and languages in a very economical way. Keeps me fit. It's the best way to meet people. The amount of invites I've had, they just wouldn't have existed. If I was driving through in a car, that just wouldn't have existed. I was offered a lift actually quite recently by a nice Swiss couple in like a big motorhome. It was raining. But if I'd have taken that lift, I would have missed out on so much adventure in between, good and bad. But it's just the best way to experience a country, is by bicycle. And I have camper vanned around Australia, and that's also great, but you know, you're sealed off in your little vehicle and you're not experiencing like every climb or, you know, every scent
along the way and the sounds. And,
you have to be out in it.
There's something very specific, the speed of a bicycle journey, right? Like it's faster than foot, but it's way slower than a car. And there's sort of a sweet spot in there for the way that you can experience a place.
It's the perfect speed.
I've heard it best described at traveling at the speed of life. And I love that expression.
Yeah.
Because you're so vulnerable too when you're traveling in a foreign country. I find that I'm far more open, and I must actually somehow transmit that to others, because people are always trying to help. They're always giving you directions. A lot of times the directions are wrong, but they're always people. I think when you travel, especially the way you're traveling, you're so open. And you said it earlier that you're not wrapped in glass and steel in a caravan going across the outback. You're open to conversations, to people, you're vulnerable. And I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah. And people are just thrilled to meet you as well. Like you have a lot of privilege when you're riding a bicycle. You know, people tolerate you sleeping in mosques because they understand that you can't just ride the 80 kilometers or whatever it is to the next hotel. So as long as you're respectful and friendly, then people are very happy to welcome you and let you sleep in a place that isn't designed for me to sleep in. But that doesn't happen. If you have a car, then you might get told, no,
I know.
You know, go and stay in a hotel. But on a bicycle, you get, you know, people are just, they're very impressed with you. They're very pleased to meet you. And more often than not, people will go out of their way to help you in any way they can because you've come by bicycle.
Mm-hmm. It just opens doors, doesn't it? And it opens hearts too.
Yeah. I think especially people are, you know, when you tell them that you've cycled here from England, that I think they're just very proud that you've chosen to visit their country, you know, especially countries that are quite new to tourism or tourism is quite limited. I think people feel very proud that you've looked at a map and said, oh, I want to go there and picked their country. And it's a, it's a matter of pride for them as well.
So you, I heard one interview, you talked about a Bill Bryson quote, and I love Bill Bryson, so I was happy to hear that. In his, I don't know if you read In a Sunburned Country, where he describes coming to Australia as a tourist.
Oh, yeah, I think it's called Down Under, the, yeah.
No, it's In a Sunburned Country, and it is, like, you just, you're laughing out loud. If you're sitting in an airplane, it's embarrassing because it's so funny. But you mentioned a quote. And I think I found the quote, and it's a long quote, but he basically says that hesitating at street corners to decide whether that cheerful and homey restaurant you will remember fondly for years is likely to lie down this street or that one, ? I just love it. I could spend my life arriving each evening in a new city. And I think that's what you're doing. I mean, every day you're arriving in a strange land.
Yeah, one of my favorite things is when I cross the border into a new country, because if I've spent probably, let's say, the maximum 3 months, whatever the visa is, in the previous country, and you've just sort of got the hang of, you recognize, if it's a script you don't understand or read very well, you can recognize when something's a supermarket, and you know what foods that you like, you know how the ATMs, which bank will accept your ATM card or which won't. You've just sort of got the hang of it after 3 months, and then you cross the border and it's like, whoop.
Exactly. Everything's new again.
And it's my favorite thing is to be in a new country and not know what's going on.
Discomfort. You embrace the discomfort of it.
I guess it's learning, and it's experiencing new things, and you know, being outside of your comfortable zone. It's the best sensation for me.
Well, most people who live more quote unquote traditional lives, our comfort zones are measured in spans of years, and yours are sometimes in weeks or months, right? So it's very, very, and you've made yourself obviously incredibly adaptable as a result.
In many ways, yeah. I'm not very good. I'm not good at dealing with crises or, you know, changing plans. They come naturally to me, but I guess it's in many ways it's a learned behavior. I have had to get better at being spontaneous and accepting spontaneous offers. It's something that's come with practice for me. It's not natural.
So what are, for people who are not world travelers or bike packers, what are some items that you would never go without when you travel? Like over the 71,000 K, there must be certain bits of kit that you absolutely would not leave home without, or leave your tent without, or the next town without.
Well, let's say the phone is a given, shall we?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I don't have a bike computer. I don't have a laptop, so everything communication-wise and photos is done on the phone. Separate from that, I think a new addition that, again, I was gifted is a solar panel, which has been invaluable for charging a power bank. I do have a dynamo in the front wheel, which is great on days that I'm cycling. Like if I'm not cycling that day, then I'm not getting any power to my power bank. And also if I'm not going fast enough, if I'm going slowly through, like, you know, corrugated sands, then that's not going to charge anything. So mm-hmm. The solar panel has been really good for the last couple of years. My tent is really good. It's a good quality tent, but air mattresses, they come and go. I don't think I have many luxury items. Glancing over my stuff now.
What's your tent?
MSR Hubba Hubba NX. So it's a two-person tent, which is like a big palace for me now. Yep. But yeah, lots of room to bring the bags in, and yeah, plenty of room.
Keeps you dry.
Lightweight. Well, it did. It's 6 years old now, and it's lost a lot of its waterproofing. But when I set off last year onto this trip, I kind of looked at, you know, I've tried the you know, the re-waterproofing stuff that you put in a washing machine, and that. So I thought about re-waterproofing it, but then I said, nah, I'm going to the Middle East. How wet can it be? It's actually been quite a wet winter. But
I saw you in a driving rainstorm the other day.
Oh, who knew that it rained that much in Saudi Arabia? Ridiculous.
Maybe this podcast will get one of your Patreon donors to send you a new tent. So there you go.
Well, yeah, I'm open to that for sure.
So on that note, I think it's a good segue. I mean, we could have multiple podcasts, and once you get to Africa, we're obviously going to hook up with you again because I want to hear how this is going. But we can, in our show notes, you can send me all your different links. Obviously, Hells on Wheels, hells.onwheels, is that what it is on Instagram?
Instagram is hells.on.wheels, one L in Hells, hells.on.wheels. And then Facebook and YouTube, it's just Hells on Wheels.
Excellent. We'll put the it's the best good handle job. Ever, especially since your last name is Dainty.
Imagine the time I had in school with that one. But
so good.
Yep.
Well, this has been. It's funny how life. As I walk out of that hypermarket in Oman, see you, and now you're on our podcast. My second episode, so I'm just sort of drafting behind Pete. But we wish you all the best. Please keep in touch. And we will put all your links in our show notes, and we'll be putting out some more information on you. I know you don't need more followers because you've got loads of followers, but I encourage people to go to your Instagram account. Super well done. Lots of effort goes into it. You put a ton of effort into it, and YouTube as well. So we'll be in touch.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Helen. What a pleasure to meet you.
Ride safe. And we'll hook up when you're in Africa, or maybe even inshallah. In Jordan or Israel. Yeah, inshallah.
Awesome.
Okay, shukran. Okay, see you, Helen.
Be well.
Thanks very much. Take care.
Another thank you to Helen, and thank you everybody for listening. If you're able to give us a positive rating or review on whatever podcast platform you're finding the show, that is greatly appreciated. It helps us find new audience members, and we will be back very soon with another episode.